to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights on the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they are not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observed the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended mourning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The mourning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household, which is to be followed by their faithful followers.
Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon are among the other Muslim countries marking the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
While honoring her immense sacrifices and services in the path of Islam, participants in the ceremonies described Fatima Zahra as the best role model, not only for the Muslims, but for the followers of all religions. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The EU started out as a peace project. Some lawmakers say the bloc is becoming more authoritarian. A meeting of justice ministers on Friday heard at least €300 billion worth of Russian assets inside the EU have been frozen since March.
There are 1,359 individuals and companies on our sanctions list with assets and financial resources all over the EU. We cannot let anything slip through the net.
With even more sanctions on the way for Moscow, EU officials are now using torture analogies.
Every time that there is a need, we turn the screw further.
But at what price? The EU's energy sanctions targeting Russia are strangling the bloc's economy. Rents and mortgages are rising steadily. Young people in precarious jobs are at greatest risk.
Very, very bad. Really bad. It's like everybody knows somebody that lose a job, that lose that is their people losing houses, families losing houses.
It's quite depressing for us to think that, for example, as for me, I'm studying a degree and I'm nearly certain that I'm not going to find a job when I'm done with it.
EU social affairs ministers met here in Brussels on Friday.
Many people, many households are facing difficult moments, and we should leave nobody behind.
Charities say it's already too late for many and words need to be replaced by actions. At the same time, the EU is able to send billions of euro to the Ukrainian army and government. We do not hear anything about peace negotiations. Instead, EU leaders will meet here next Thursday to agree on more funding for Ukraine's army. On the same day, the European Central Bank will announce interest rates are to go up further. Critics say that priorities are all wrong. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, a string of anti-system parties labelled by the Italian media as the forces of dissent gathered in Rome to discuss the challenges being faced by Italy and the EU and future strategies. The meeting was attended by political groups including More Sovereign and Popular Italy, Reclaim Italy, an alternative, formations advocating for the protection of Italy's sovereign interests and for shielding a growing number of Italians who are paying a heavy toll to what they call a dictatorship of neoliberalism.
In short, we are under a dictatorship, a regime that has stripped us all of dignity, rights. We can't get decent jobs anymore. Our constitution has been vilified. Our youngest generations have been taught the wrong values.
Independent journalists and geopolitical analysts also attended the meeting. They slammed the EU for its vulnerability to corruption and NATO for its belligerent posture. They also argued that the energy crisis was purposely triggered to favor the energy giants and their shareholders.
NATO is primarily responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. A long-planned operation which has also involved the US Secret Services since the 2014 coup in Ukraine. We believe nations should reclaim their sovereignty and be free to strengthen ties with any country they want.
This affection for politics is running wild in Italy. The turnout for last September's general elections was about 64%, the lowest ever recorded, 9% down compared to the 2018 vote.
Our party was boycotted when we ran in the elections last September. The Italian media simply ignored us. Furthermore, about 4 out of 10 Italians did not vote, meaning that the current parliament only partially represents the will of the people.
Following the outcome of Italy's latest elections held in September, which saw a right-wing coalition led by Giorgia Meloni emerging as winners, all anti-system parties have remained out of the parliament. The once anti-establishment five-star movement managed to garner 18% of the votes, but its action in the parliament seemed to have lost both power and potential now that the party has moved towards more moderate stances. Max Civili, Rome.
Since the riots began in September, anti-Iran media has been depicting the situation as a violent crackdown on so-called peaceful protesters. For the past 2 months, they have been running a propaganda campaign to further pressure Iran under the pretext of violating human rights. But are these peaceful protesters? Iran's intelligence ministry has recently reported the confiscation of huge cache of weapons and equipment used by terrorists. In fact, Iranian security forces have thwarted several arms smuggling operations and dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the terrorist organizations such as MKO. This comes as the illegal influx of weapons into the country is on the rise recently. The confiscated weapons were supposed to be transferred to Iran to be used in the recent riots. Last month, in an interview with the Persian service of the British state-funded broadcaster BBC, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said the, quote, Iranian opposition is now being armed with weapons. Bolton added that these arms are being smuggled into the country from the Iraq's Kurdistan region, praising the use of force against Iran's security forces. The recent foreign-backed riots in Iran have claimed hundreds of lives belonging to both security forces and ordinary people. In addition, by conducting acts of vandalism, violence, and insecurity, rioters have paved the way for separatist and terrorist groups to infiltrate the country and carry out brutal attacks against innocent people.
Smuggling huge amounts of weapons into Iran to be used in the recent foreign-backed unrest is merely aimed at undermining the country's security. But Iranian officials have time and again stated that Iran's security is a red line that no one is allowed to cross. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Lebanon has arrested 185 people suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency since October 2019, when the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis became apparent.
This is Israel's intelligence agency's invasion of the Lebanese virtual sovereignty. The Israelis took advantage of the economic crisis and the fact that the Lebanese are looking for job opportunities with US dollars coming from abroad. And so they created fake companies through which they acquired thousands of resumes from Lebanese people. They were able to contact any one of those job hunters in the guise of foreign companies, while in reality they were Israeli recruiters.
Lebanese security sources have told AFP that the number has increased dramatically, from only 4 or 5 arrests per year.
One of the most notable examples of this was the busting of over 35 Lebanese and Palestinians that were gathering intelligence on Hezbollah and of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon for Israel. Israel, again, used a lot of fake companies and front groups to trap those kind of in a desperate economic situation into accepting these fake front opportunities.
Out of the 185 people arrested since 2019, 165 have been prosecuted and 25 convicted and sentenced. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in several ways, but it seems it's not the only reason for treason. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their communications with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to the resistance.
When we read the interrogation reports of those who were arrested, we understand that it was more than only giving intelligence. One of the suspects admits that he was asked to write articles aimed at sowing sedition amongst the Lebanese and inciting people against Hezbollah and resistance. They asked him, for example, to write articles which would give an impression that Hezbollah is linked to the Beirut port explosion in order to provoke hatred against the resistance movement.
Political analysts believe recruiting spies by the Israeli regime will continue since a military option is not on the table.
These kinds of more subtle forms of gaining influence in Lebanon and especially putting people into a very desperate economic state and taking advantage of that seems to both basically cut the losses on the military front that Israel and the U.S. Even know that it has unmatched against the resistance forces in the region.
Although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with Israel, there has been no direct confrontation between the two sides since 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities have never stopped. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The 18th International Muslim Forum has summed up celebrations of the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the Volga, Bulgaria. Many religious figures addressed the International Forum. Russian Mufti Sheikh Ravil Gaynuddin called for a just world order from the standpoint of the East. Chairman of the Turkish Department of Religious Affairs, Ali Erbaş, spoke about the connection between justice and security. Chief Justice of Palestine, Mahmoud Al-Habash, accused Israel and the United States of violating international law. The main two words, justice and a new world order, became the leitmotif of the plenary session.
We have gathered here to raise the voice of justice and moderation, to exchange scientific opinions through dialogue. The Islamic State, the Muslims of Russia, all of us must stand together against the liberalism that they are trying to impose on us. This false world view is in fact engaged in the seizure of the world's material wealth and assets. Our joint cooperation should be directed against this upstart arrogance, despotism, and oppression of the liberal world. The Islamic principles of the world view are the values that the world could take as an example.
Back in 1881, the Russian Muslim thinker and educator Ismail B. Gasprinsky wrote that in the near future, quote, Russia will be destined to become one of the significant Muslim states, which will not in the least diminish its significance as a great Christian power. The participants of the forum are convinced that his dream is coming true today. Russian Muslims, hand in hand with their partners, are making a unique contribution to renewing the global discourse on justice. The rapprochement of the Islamic world with Russia and success in this matter is directly related to the openness of the Russian civilization to its Eastern heritage, including the spiritual tradition of Russian Muslims.
We are being imposed a globalist neoliberal understanding of the modern world order. The imposition is very aggressive. They encroached on a family. Many have caved into these patterns of the new world order. The Islamic world, which reads the Quran and is charged with energy and the word of the Quran, is trying to resist and adjoin those centers that are able to challenge and protect humanity from destructive energy. Russia is the defender of the classical traditional order set forth in the sacred scriptures. Therefore, one must follow this path, not lose hope, not give up, because this is a Quranic instruction to unite and be a single organism, a single ummah.
The participants of the forum believe that the time has come to talk about a just world order not only from the standpoint of the West, but also from the East.
Russia is celebrating the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the people of Volga, Bulgaria, marking the importance of Islam in the country. This year is commemorated with the participation of representatives from dozens of Muslim countries during various events. The anniversary is also an opportunity for Russia to strengthen its ties with participating Muslim countries that have been isolated by the West. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say UK recession could turn into a lost decade. The UK faces a lost decade of growth if action isn't taken to address the slumping business investment and worker shortages. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg noted, the UK is facing a fresh wave of industrial turmoil as Rishi Sunak's government refuses to boost pay offers for large numbers of public sector workers, arguing that to do so would drive the nation's double-digit inflation rate even higher. The disputes over pay are just the tip of the iceberg for the Prime Minister. The British people are facing the biggest drop in living standards on record. Essential services like transport and healthcare are crumbling, and the country's mounting interest payments are squeezing public finances despite taxes at the highest in 70 years. One faction in his governing Conservative Party argues that Sunak has resigned himself to the UK's economic decline and is simply trying to manage that process. Those lawmakers want bolder action to revive growth, but their champion Liz Truss and her chance to execute on that plan and comprehensively mess it up. The result is growing anger and unrest among the British workforce. A two-day train operators' strike starts very soon. Planned walkouts this week include driving examiners, Royal Mail postal workers, bus drivers, highway workers, and ground handling staff at Heathrow Airport. The UK is in the grip of the sharpest drop in living standards on record. Most worrying for Sunak is when Royal College of Nursing staff strike for the first time in their history. The government is seeking to face down the strikes, threatening tough new legislation to restrict stoppages and preparing to call in the army to help run essential services. With the opposition Labour Party riding high in polls, Britain's worst industrial strife since 1980s is a key test for Sunak less than 2 months into his premiership. There are worrying echoes from history for the government after 12 years in power and an election looming. Industrial action in 1970s swept away an exhausted Labour government and ushered Margaret Thatcher into office. Meanwhile, Guardian noted UK facing tough road as recession looms despite economy growing in October as it happened. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt warns economy likely to get worse before improving after UK GDP rose 0.5% in October but shrank by 0.3% in the August-October quarter. China Daily also wrote, as Britain's economic crisis spreads from spiraling inflation and high cost of living to weak productivity, experts believe the negative impact of Brexit has become more evident after initially being masked by the COVID-19 pandemic. In its recent economic and fiscal outlook analysis, the Office for Budget Responsibility said that Brexit will result in the UK's trade intensity being 15% lower in the long run than if the UK had remained in the European Union. Trade intensity measures an economy's integration with the world economy. The new research by the London School of Economics found that leaving the EU had already cost UK consumers a total of £5.8 billion over the 2 years up to the end of 2021, adding an average of £210 to household food bills. Jim O'Neill, a leading British sinologist and former UK Treasury Minister, said that while the UK faced the same headwinds globally, COVID-19, energy price developments, the splintering of global governance and climate change policies, it had two huge homemade dilemmas, weak productivity and Brexit. He added, "I think it looks clearer and clearer that Brexit is a legitimate reason why the UK is struggling. It is struggling both because of our very weak export performance to our biggest market, the EU, and significant labour shortages in so many sectors of UK economy." Aside from Russia, the UK is expected to be the worst performer among the world's leading economies in the next 2 years, according to the latest economic outlook analysis by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The Paris-based organization has forecast that the UK's GDP will fall by 0.4% in 2023 and rise by 0.2% in 2024. Michael Saunders, a senior economic advisor at Oxford Economics, said Brexit has weakened the UK economy significantly since 2019, along with effects from the pandemic and energy price shock. Saunders pointed out that the UK's business investment had underperformed compared with other major economies since 2016. reduced trade intensity is bad for long-run productivity growth, Brexit is likely to be a continued drag on the UK economy in coming years, he added. John Burney, vice chair of research at the Asian Development Bank Institute, a think tank, said, once the effects of the pandemic and the Ukraine situation gradually dissipate, global trade will eventually recover. This will further expose the effects of Brexit on the UK's economic trajectory, given the constraints to engage fully in global trade recovery. Burney said he believed this also had indirect effects on other parts of the economy, amplifying labour market frictions and productivity concerns and hampering potential output. Inflation in the UK hit a 41-year high of 11.1% in October on the back of rising energy and food prices. In an effort to tackle the cost of living crisis and rebuild the economy, Jeremy Hunt, the country's Chancellor of the Exchequer, outlined a £55 billion package of tax increases and spending cuts for the UK, which he said would allow inflation and interest rates to be significantly lower. However, Dave Ramsden, Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, said at a recent conference at King's College London that tax increases and spending cuts announced by Hunt were unlikely to persuade the central bank to moderate a future increase in interest rates. Experts agree that over the medium term, the fiscal consolidation measures announced will help to alleviate debt sustainability concerns, but that this is not enough to put the UK's economic growth on track. These measures aim to ensure that public finances will return to a sustainable path, even if economic trend remains sluggish, Saunders said, adding, but the autumn statement did not really contain significant measures to address the UK's poor underlying economic performance. The cuts to public investment will probably make it harder to lift medium-term growth trends. O'Neill said the UK desperately needed a different framework, what you might call a more imaginative and modern golden rule to allow more ambitious government investment spending. It is the only way to really get out of our low productivity and investment trap, he said. The UK recession is expected to span a two-year period from the third quarter of 2022 until the second quarter of 2024. A peak in the tightening interest rate cycle and shift in the projected outlook for inflation could signal a turning point for the trajectory of the economy, whereby policy objectives would gradually pivot from combating inflation toward stimulating growth, Burney said. Saunders said the economy could get some support if, as futures markets imply, wholesale energy prices drop over the next couple of years. However, the economy's underlying medium-term growth trend is unlikely to improve unless the government introduces a series of supply-side strategy consisting of, say, closer trade links with Europe, higher public investment, and increased spending on education, skills, and infrastructure.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
€1 billion from some 70 countries in immediate aid to help Ukraine get through a harsh winter. So much money was pledged that out of the €1 billion, €493 million, roughly half of it was not even designated. Meanwhile, the U.S. has just announced another batch of aid. When the U.S. Treasury Secretary was asked recently for how long will that level of U.S. support to carry on, Janet Yellen said, as long as it takes. Is that code for we want the war to continue? Isn't this money by the U.S. and EU being splurged at the expense of millions of others in their own country who are in need of health care, education, or food? Welcome to the Spotlight. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Gilbert Doctorow joins us. He's an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, I'll first start with you. Taking a look at the aid that's being pledged for Ukraine, the most recent one was the more than $40 billion in additional aid to Ukraine that was approved by Congress, bringing the U.S. commitment to the Ukraine conflict to $54 billion. This was combined. Well, you know what? There's so many aid figures that I have for the U.S. that I can't even tell you. I get confused. I'm curious as to this aid that first the U.S. is pledging to Ukraine in the amounts that it is and in the frequency that it is. Is it yielding the results that the U.S. wants to see from this conflict?
I think that we're talking about Washington politics and the view in Washington, at least, you know, the establishment view is that the money is well spent, that Russia is being kept occupied. Russia is bleeding. Ukraine is still standing. And the price tag is, you know, it's humongous. I think that the total you were probably groping for was around $100 billion all told. But compared to other, other things, it's not very much. And so I think that the view in Washington is that it is a good investment. Whether or not, I think it is prolonging the war. I think Ukraine would have folded a long time ago if it weren't for all this aid, not just the arms and training and advice and intelligence help, but just cash to pay to fill out the Ukrainian budget. So I think that's what's keeping Ukraine going.
Okay, Fred Weir mentioned the figure of $100 billion. Gilbert Doctorow, that is roughly the right figure. It isn't roughly. I think it is the right figure because what I have from the Kiel Institute tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries, and that was from January 24th to October 3rd of 2022, of which out of that, 52.3 billion came from the U.S., 29.2 from the European Union, and 12.3 again, in euros, from other countries, mostly from the United Kingdom. When you take a look at the money that's being pledged to Ukraine, what does that spell? Because some say, in one respect, it means the war should go on. Do you see the pledging of money to equate to that?
They're pledging what they can provide. Whether or not that is efficient, is productive, is an entirely separate question, which doesn't bother them in the least. Efficacy has gone out the window a long time ago. We are talking about political posturing here. If the West, if the United States, had what the Ukrainians need, that in terms of military support, that would be one thing. The reality is the war is being fought on Russia's terms. This war is an artillery war. And in artillery, Russians have the stores and Russians have the production capacity currently many, many times greater than the United States and its allies have to provision Ukraine. So in the area that is decisive for the outcome of this war, Russia is ahead, and all of these pledges are virtually meaningless in terms of Ukrainian military prospects. Financial aid is a different story, and I agree entirely with Fred Ware that the financial assistance from the United States and from Europe has been decisive in allowing the Ukrainian government to stand, to pay the salaries of its administrators, of its government, and its pensioners and the rest of it. But as regards military prospects, that's a wholly different situation, and you cannot give what you do not have. The Russians have it, the West does not.
Fred Weir, the news on this is contradictory and is conflicting. You have on the one hand a senior Ukrainian official saying Ukraine is running out of vital weapons. Kiev is starting to feel the shortage of what it said was anti-air capabilities. On the other hand, you have other sources like the Defense Post website stating that Russia has admitted that it may be running short on supplies. What is the story on either side?
Well, nobody really knows. I've been trying to look into this in Russia, and most of what you want to know is top secret. That's common in wartime. I think that in Ukraine, you can't get the slightest accurate figure about anything. In the West, there's a little bit more transparency, and it is clear that their stockpiles are running down. They've just poured so much into Ukraine that the military, you know, it's hard to believe that the military forces of the most powerful alliance in history are running out of basic equipment and materiel. But how imminent that is, I mean, the actual running out of ammunition, nobody knows. And in Russia, too, I think, from what I can find out, I would not underestimate the ability of Russian industry to provide what the Russian military needs. They have huge stockpiles, that's one thing. But, you know, the things you hear people saying, suggesting that maybe the Kalashnikov works can't produce enough assault rifles, or Ural wagons of odd enough tanks for the Russian army, history suggests otherwise.
Well, also there is reports indicating, Gilbert Doctorow, that the U.S. is running low on weapons. And in particular, this is what one of their outlets from the U.S. Reported on some advanced weapons system and munitions. Does the fact that the U.S. is running low on weapons, what does that mean? And we need to take a look at this because I guess the ultimate question I'm asking is, does the longevity of the war and the duration of the war depend on the supply of weapons?
Yes and no. It depends on the Russians' strategy for proceeding. If they wanted to have the offensive that has been much talked about and which would seemingly be supported by the mobilization that took place from September, if they wanted to have a knockout blow on the ground against Ukrainian forces, that's one thing. That I can say that prospect has been dimming in the last few days, even weeks. We expected by mid-December, when the ground hardens in Ukraine from frost, that the Russians would make a move. There is nothing to suggest that that is happening now. Or there are hints coming out of the Kremlin that there may be a late spring offensive. In the meantime, what Russia is doing is a different war. It is the war of attrition. It is the destruction of the infrastructure in Ukraine, which will have the effect of depopulating further the major cities because they become uninhabitable. Here in Belgium, we're now experiencing weather on the order of zero in the daytime and -5, -6 at night. That is exactly what Kiev is experiencing. And I can tell you, from what I see around me and from living here, it is unimaginable that one could stay in a city, at least and particularly stay in a city that has so many high-rise residential blocks with no heating, no electricity, and no water. That is unimaginable. So it is only a question of weeks before there's a big exodus from Kiev and other cities, Lvov, other cities that have been particularly affected by the Russians' destruction of the power generation. That is the second type of war. It is a war that is supported by drones and to a limited extent by the Air Force, though the Russian Air Force is carrying out its missions away from the Ukrainian territory. These are long-distance missiles that are being fired by Russian Air Force. So the war has peculiarities which are being dictated by the Russians as they do their own calculus on how to proceed without inviting a direct confrontation and a NATO-Russia war that escalates to nuclear. There are calculations here which are very specific to the confrontation between the world's two nuclear powers. And Mr. Putin has been very prudent and very careful, some people will say he's been overcautious, to avoid that precisely that escalation to nuclear war.
I see.
And for these reasons, the calculations of what the West has by munitions, what Russia has by munitions, is missing the point. The Russians are deciding how the war is being prosecuted. And they're deciding that precisely with the intent of avoiding an escalation to nuclear.
All right. We have to take a look at what the Russian president has said there, Fred Weir, because it may indicate as to the direction of this war, where it may go. In the most recent statement regarding on weapons now, we know that Vladimir Putin has said, you know, the more you pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this war is going to take, and it's going to lead to more destruction. But he said that the West had de facto turned Ukraine into a colony and is using Ukrainians as cannon fodder and a battering ram against Russia while supplying Kiev with weapons. Can you explain to us what that means there?
Well, I think the Russians have been saying this from the start, that they're not fighting Ukraine as such. They're fighting the United West or NATO, who are using Ukraine in this way, battering ram as an anti-Russian instrument. This is what the Russians say. And, you know, the things that NATO leaders say tends to corroborate that. For instance, Jens Stoltenberg saying a defeat for Ukraine would be a defeat for NATO. You know, that's exactly what Putin is claiming. So to some extent, and I think it remains to be figured out, calculated, this is definitely a proxy war.
Okay.
And I think that the greatest danger here is that Ukraine is going to be destroyed in the process of it.
It sure is. Well, that statement that you said there is what I need to ask you, Gilbert Doctorow. Jan Stoltenberg saying a defeat for Ukraine is a defeat for NATO. I'd like to get your reaction on that. But on the other hand, I want to also ask you whether that is a tactic that's being used not only by NATO, but maybe the U.S. pushing onto other European countries to scare them into thinking that they're next.
Well, I don't think the United States has to scare them particularly. Going back months, the way the Europeans entered on the sanctions program in hydrocarbons, committing suicide, that was already the indication that these countries were scared to death of Russia's flexing its muscles, because it revealed their powerlessness and their military shortcomings, which only could be compensated for by very active American participation in the conflict. So there's no need to look at what happened in the last several weeks. If you go back months, as I say, the Europeans all lined up like so many ducks following the United States into what is for them economic suicide, because they are were frightened by the exposure of their own military weakness before Russian strength.
The notion of peace talks has come up on a few occasions, not so often recently, Fred Weir. I'd like to get your thoughts on what Zelensky demanded, which was on the three steps. This was on December 13th. I need to make a note of that date to you. A couple of them was about sending more advanced arms and then some money. But the third one referred to a 10-step peace formula, of which at the core of it, which pretty much Russia is rejecting, is the fact that it wants Russia to relinquish all lands that, based on Kiev, considers to be under its own sovereignty. Why would he make a proposal for peace at this point, especially given the fact that he knows that Russia would outright reject one of those provisions, which is obviously the four regions that, that went through a referendum?
I don't think he made a proposal for peace. I think he's under some pressure, especially from Europeans, to be more sound, more conciliatory. But what he made there was a proposal for more arms and more money for Kiev. Obviously, that's what that was about. And I don't think that there is any grounds for a negotiated, even the opening of negotiations at this point. It clearly, the two sides are so far apart, and neither side has really stated what they want. I mean, they make these, especially Kiev makes these maximalist demands, but what would they maybe accept in certain circumstances? Because we remember back in March, they did. They were right on the verge of accepting a peace settlement. So clearly there is a...
You mean when talks were happening in Turkey at that time?
Yeah, that's right. They were derailed, but it was on the table. It was, you could practically, like there was even, I remember that weekend, there was some feeling of euphoria that maybe this thing can end. Well, not anymore. And now I think that we're going to have to see more developments on the battlefield. That something will have to change, something decisive will have to be established before there is any talk of negotiations.
Gilbert Doctorow, I can't help but ask, why is it that when either Zelensky or the U.S. President Joe Biden talks about any type of peace, it's not taken as serious as when the Russian President Vladimir Putin says that he's open to it if the four regions that went through a referendum is accepted by Ukraine and de facto perhaps the U.S.? It seems like when he's saying that he perhaps means it, or is that a wrong interpretation?
No, he means it. The Russians are prepared to go as far as necessary, meaning to the Romanian border, and the softening up of Odessa by recent attacks, air attacks, missile attacks by the Russians, is an indication of where they are headed, if need be. Will they deprive Ukraine of access to the sea? If need be, yes. But they are clearly hinting, as you just suggested, at a settlement that doesn't destroy the viability of the remaining Ukrainian state. The unacceptability of Putin's proposals to the Ukrainian side is self-evident. So in a way, what Mr. Putin was saying is as declaratory and posturing as what Mr. Zelensky was saying. Neither side is really ready for a peace at this stage when there has been no decisive military victory that they can claim. Will there be a decisive military victory? As I say, it depends very much on the Kremlin's decision how to prosecute this war further while avoiding the possibility of a nuclear escalation. If it remains where it is now, which is the inch by inch, meter by meter, kilometer by kilometer, progressive advance of Russian forces in Donetsk Oblast. After all, it was to to retake the Donbas to its pre-existing borders, which was what the first objective of the Russian special military operation. That is proceeding. If it is a question of grinding down the Ukrainian military, the reports that we receive from last week suggest that as many as 800 casualties on the Ukrainian side every day in the Donbas region, but not to mention other fronts. So the Ukrainians are running out of not just ammunition, they're running out of reserves and out of their ability to regenerate their army at the level of casualties that they are now experiencing by making their hopeless attacks on the Russian fortified positions.
All right, since we talked a little bit about possibility of agreements or not, this made a lot of news, Fred Weir, and what the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel stated in terms of the Minsk agreements when she said, quote, the Minsk agreements were an attempt to give Ukraine time. Of course, Vladimir Putin was disappointed by what she had said, and she said, and he said that, you know, this is another case where you can't trust the West. And he said that their point was only to load up Ukraine with weapons. It's something that Russia should have seen. Do you think that that was really indeed the case? And if we're looking at the possibility of other agreements, that perhaps there's going to be this type of, sneakiness to go on?
I think that Merkel was talking. I mean, she's trying to justify herself and the choices and decisions she made in hindsight to a certain extent. But that admission that the Minsk agreements were mainly designed to give Ukraine time to strengthen, to recover from the military defeat that they did suffer in 2014-2015, that is kind of damning. The Russians are in the room listening to that, and not only them. The Serbians are listening to that. Everybody is. And the duplicity, I can't think of a more appropriate word, on display there is going to come back to haunt.
All right, a final question. You talked about deaths, and I need to get this out to get some idea on this, Gilbert Doctor. And that is what von der Leyen stated in a press conference, of which those figures were taken out, and that was 100,000 or over 20,000 civilians and 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in Ukraine. What is the deal there? You have Mark Milley, of the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chief of Staff, that said over 100,000 Russian soldiers were killed and also 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers. What kind of death count is there?
Well, for the reasons that were discussed by Fred Weir earlier, these statistics are kept under close guard in Russia, and they are the figures that we get from